If I was Universal Times, stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. The U.S. to accept Syrian refugees. The United States says it will take in at least 10,000 Syrian refugees in the coming year. White House spokesman Josh Earnest says the U.S. will also increase its humanitarian aid for those fleeing the violence in Syria.
The president has directed his team to consider how we can further scale up our response.
Spokesman Josh Earnest says background checks on the new arrivals will be robust to ensure U.S. national security is not endangered. The European Parliament, meanwhile, overwhelmingly voted to support a call by European Commission Chief Jean-Claude Juncker for country-by-country mandatory refugee quotas over the next 2 years. Romania rejected the quota plan, as did Slovakia. Hungary says it hopes to complete a fence by early next month to keep more refugees from entering. Al-Qaeda-led rebels killed 56 Syrian government soldiers during an assault on an airbase in Idlib province. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the soldiers are either killed during the capture of Abu al-Duhur airbase, located in the northwestern Syrian province, or afterwards. 40 soldiers were taken prisoner and dozens of others are missing. Syrian state television confirmed government troops had left the base. The fossilized bones of 15 members of an ancient species believed related to humans have been found in a cave in South Africa. The hominid, described as a new species of human, has been named Homo naledi after the Rising Star Cave where the bones were found. The find was announced Thursday by an international team of scientists led by Lee Berger, an American paleanthropologist. This is VOA News. U.S. Senate Democrats have blocked a vote of disapproval on the nuclear accord with Iran. We get details from VOA's Michael Bowman.
Opponents of the nuclear pact fell 2 votes short of the 60 required to end Senate debate on a resolution disapproving the nuclear pact. The procedural vote followed days of impassioned floor debate. Republican Senator Orrin Hatch explained his opposition.
It is not a cavalier attitude about war that leads me to oppose this deal. It is my unwavering judgment that this deal makes war much more likely.
Democratic Senator Tom Carper said Iran's nuclear ambitions will be kept in check.
We have the ability to know if they cheat. If they cheat, we have the ability to put right back in place these same crippling economic sanctions. And if that doesn't do the job, we have other alternatives at our disposal.
Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
President Obama called it a victory for diplomacy, for American national security, and for the safety and security of the world. The World Food Program is expanding its aid program for hundreds of thousands who are suffering from hunger and have fled to Chad, Niger, and Cameroon to escape attacks with Boko Haram militants in northeastern Nigeria. Lisa Schlein has details.
The World Food Program says nearly 750,000 people in countries bordering Nigeria are facing a worsening food crisis linked to increased violence by Boko Haram militants. WFP spokeswoman Bettina Lucia tells VOA that recent attacks have led to a sudden surge of internally displaced people and refugees.
They are telling harrowing stories about fleeing from the violence, being on the run, sometimes traveling for several days.
WFP says it plans to increase food aid to more than 650,000 vulnerable people in Chad, Niger, and Cameroon. Lisa Schlein, Geneva.
U.S. federal agents have arrested a Florida man for allegedly being part of a plot to blow up a bomb during Friday, September 11th memorial service in Kansas City, Missouri. The Justice Department says 20-year-old Joshua Ryan Goldberg handed out information to an undercover FBI agent on how to build a pressure cooker bomb, similar to the bombs that killed 3 and wounded 264 at the Boston Marathon in 2013. Goldberg allegedly told the agent to fill the bomb with nails, pieces of metal, and rat poison and put it at the September 11th memorial. Goldberg faces 20 years in prison if he is tried and convicted. And the Palestinian flag will be flown alongside those of full member states at the UN. The General Assembly voted Thursday 119 in favor and 8 against to allow non-member observer states to raise their flags at UN headquarters and offices. The Palestinians and the Vatican are the only 2 UN non-member observer states. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Story Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Friday, September 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan's National Assembly ratifies the recent peace agreement with the rebels.
The Right Honorable Speaker and Honorable Member of the National Legislature, allow me to present to you this agreement entitled Agreement on the Resolution of the Conflict in the Republic of South Sudan.
Paulino Wanawila Onago is the South Sudan's justice minister. The rebels of former Vice President Riek Machar also ratified the agreement yesterday. Zimbabwe says it will soon present a plan to pay its international debt. And Uganda's Electoral Commission tells former Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi to follow the electoral law.
We put out a roadmap indicating the activities and their time frames. Who is Amama Mbabazi not follow electoral laws?
Jotam Tarambwa is the spokesman for Uganda's Electoral Commission. A former U.S. diplomat will reflect on his encounters with two former Liberian presidents, Samuel Doe and Charles Taylor. And in the wake of allegations of police brutality, U.S. police departments say they are facing a shortage of qualified applicants. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Sudan's National Assembly on Thursday ratified the peace agreement signed last month between the government and rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar to end nearly 2 years of conflict. The lawmakers voted overwhelmingly in favor of the deal. Nabil Biagio of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reports from Juba.
Justice Minister Paulino Wanawila Onango presented the IGAD brokered peace deal to the 212 lawmakers who attended today's extraordinary session of Parliament.
The Right Honorable Speaker and Honorable Member of the National Legislature, allow me to present to you this agreement entitled Agreement on the Resolution of the Conflict in the Republic of South Sudan.
Onango acknowledged that under the terms of the agreement, Parliament should have ratified the deal 7 days after President Kiir signed it on August 26th. Onango says that means the agreement should have been presented to lawmakers for a vote on September 2nd. But he says,
I would like to make clear that we received this agreement officially on the 2nd of September. So if there is a 7-day starting from the 3rd of September going on,
the lawmakers who attended today's session of Parliament voted overwhelmingly to adopt the peace deal and make it law when Parliamentary Speaker Manasi Magok-Rundial put ratification to a vote.
This is a clear agreement. It should not take much of our time. We are tasked to adopt this agreement. So do we adopt it?
The agreement calls, among other things, for a ceasefire to take effect within 72 hours of the peace deal being signed by all parties, for a government of national unity to be formed by November, and for a permanent constitution to be drawn up for South Sudan. The deal also outlines security measures that will be in effect during the transitional period, including the demilitarization of Juba and three other towns. The two main sides in South Sudan's conflict, the government and the armed opposition led by former Vice President Riek Machar, have ordered their forces to lay down arms and respect a ceasefire which officially took effect late last month. There are, however, reports of heavy fighting in parts of South Sudan, notably in the main oil-producing state Upper Nile. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
Rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar also ratified the compromise peace deal yesterday in the town of Pagak in Upper Nile State. Ezekiel Lo Gatkuf, the rebel secretary for foreign affairs, says the SPLM in opposition will form other committees to speed up the implementation of the peace deal.
We have transformed ourselves from the SPLM Leadership Council to the SPLM National Liberation Council. The meeting was chaired by the chairman of the SPLM and commander-in-chief of the SPLA, Dr. Riek Machar Teng. And we have unanimously, the whole leadership unanimously, ratified and adopted the peace agreement, which was signed by the chairman of the SPLM and commander-in-chief of the SPLA on the 17th, and also signed again by President Salva Kiir on the 26th of August. So now the whole leadership has unanimously adopted and ratified the agreement.
There is also another Liberation Council in Juba. Now, what is going to be the difference between your council and the other SPLM Liberation Council?
According to the agreement will be adopted and ratified by the SPLM-SPLA National Liberation Council on our side. And on the government side, it is going to be the Parliament of South Sudan which will be ratifying and adopting the agreement.
And what is next after adopting and ratifying the agreement?
Tomorrow we are going to dispatch our security team because they have this permanent ceasefire and security arrangement workshop in Addis Ababa starting on the 12th. So we are sending our team, 15 members team. They will be in Addis Ababa tomorrow. So they will start the workshop. And this workshop is very important for us because you will be working to identify the areas of your troops, areas of cantonment, forces that will be going to Juba, forces that will be going to all the areas in South Sudan, Juba, Bor, Malakal, Wau, Bentiu, and all those places which will be demilitarized. So now we are moving to the implementation stage of the agreement, and all the members of the leadership will start working on the transitional processes.
Ezekiel Logat-Kouf is the Secretary for Foreign Affairs of the SPLM in opposition. He was speaking from Pagag with John Tanza of VOA South Sudan in Focus program. Uganda's opposition and civil society groups have accused the Electoral Commission of bias and hypocrisy after the electoral body harshly warned former Prime Minister Patrick Amama Mbabazi to desist from consulting with his supporters. Ugandan law prevents candidates from official campaigning or addressing public mass rallies until they have been nominated to represent a political party ahead of an election. Jonathan Tarumua, spokesman for the Electoral Commission, tells reporter Peter Clotty that the electoral body wants to ensure an equal playing field ahead of next year's general election.
First and foremost, we go on the basis of the laws we have in our constitution, we have in our Electoral Commission Act. We put out a roadmap indicating the activities and their time frames. Who is Amama Mbabazi not to follow the electoral laws? He is a senior lawyer. He has been an architect of most of these laws. He should know the requirements of the laws. He cannot be the one to violate the laws. He is doing it selfishly, well knowing that it is against the law what he is doing. His ultimate purpose is to portray Electoral Commission as partisan and police as partisan so that he gains public sympathy and support.
Some are saying that the EC was to blame for issuing nomination forms to aspirants before releasing clear, specific, and detailed guidelines for consultative meetings. What do you say to that?
That is the ignorance of the process. Whoever said that is ignorant of how we did it. When we issued out the nomination form, we issued out a copy of the guidelines together with the nomination forms, and we informed all the aspirants to take their time before going out to read those guidelines. And those guidelines are clear. So they know, Honorable Mbabazi knows, that there is a difference between conducting consultations and campaigning by addressing public rallies. My request to him is that he gets back and follows the law. He is not the person who should be breaking the law.
Well, they said the decision by the Electoral Commission to stop the so-called consultative or rallies of Amama Mbabazi is the EC's move being political rather than legal, and augment their demand as an opposition to have an independent and credible commission because they doubt your credibility as being in the pockets of the NRM or the ruling party. What do you say to
that? What is being in the pockets of NRM? When we point out the sections of the law, are those sections of the NRM law? If they are talking of an independent electoral commission, do they want a commission that does not follow the law? We communicated over the aspirant, but Amama decided to violate the laws. We are not a law enforcement. We are not a law enforcement agency. Police is mandated. So when police realizes that you are going against the public order and the law, they will come in.
Jotam Taremwa is the spokesman for Uganda's Electoral Commission. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Kampala. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton, Washington. Today is Friday, September 11th. Let's send some greetings to our listeners on Kira FM in Jinja, Uganda. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. Zimbabwe's finance minister says he has given up on convincing the International Monetary Fund and other creditors to cancel the country's $10 billion debt. Now he says the country may use its natural resources in an effort to pay back the money. Sebastian Mofu has more for VOA from Harare.
Patrick Chinamasa, Zimbabwe's finance minister, held a news conference Thursday as IMF staffers finished talks with the Zimbabwean officials in Harare. He said the government held what he called frank and candid talks with the IMF regarding the country's economy.
And if we are meeting as economists, we will agree the fundamentals are not in good shape. The end game is to reach an accommodation with creditors in order to clear our arrears. I believe that we have resources which, if leveraged, can also help to get us out of our situation.
The arrears in question are debts totaling $10 billion US dollars that Zimbabwe owes to organizations such as the IMF, the World Bank, and the African Development Bank, all of which have stopped lending to the country. The resources are Zimbabwe's rich deposits of gold, diamonds, and other minerals, which, if properly exploited, could pump millions of dollars into the economy and help Zimbabwe pay back its debt. President Robert Mugabe's government blames the current situation on Western sanctions imposed on him and ruling party officials following reports of human rights abuses and election rigging in 2002. Domenico Fanica, an assistant director with IMF's African Development, says debt repayment is the key to reviving the country's economy.
And the problem for Zimbabwe is that the country cannot access financing, either from international financial institutions or bilateral trade. Why? Because it does not serve its debt. In other words, the country is heavily into arrears. So it's impossible for the country to borrow.
Last year, Chinamasa appealed in vain to the African Development Bank to write off $500 million of Zimbabwe's debt, hoping the IMF and the World Bank would do the same. Now it seems he's planning to ride the country's resources back to financial health. On Wednesday, he said Zimbabwe is sending a team to Brussels, Berlin, and Paris to present a plan to pay the debts if the creditors will give Zimbabwe time to breathe. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Herman Cohen has written a new book entitled The Mind of the African Strongman, Conversations with Dictators, Statesmen, and Father Figures, in which he concludes that Africa's underdevelopment is the fault of its leaders. In a chapter on Liberia, Ambassador Cohen describes former President Samuel Doe and Charles Taylor as two men who set Liberia back 100 years. In this account, Ambassador Cohen describes a 1987 meeting in Monrovia between Doe and then U.S. Secretary of State George Shultz. Cohen said it appeared as if Doe was having a tantrum like a six-year-old child.
Well, my first meeting with Samuel Doe, I was accompanying Secretary of State George Shultz. It was in January 1987. I had just joined the White House working for President Reagan, and Secretary Shultz says, well, I'm going to Africa. You can come with me and advise me. So I went, and his first stop was Monrovia. And a few hours later, he was in the office with Samuel Doe. It wasn't just an office. It was a large room with a lot of people on both sides. And I was just shocked because Samuel Doe started screaming at him, like my mother used to scream at me, loud voice. And Secretary Shultz was just sitting there, you know, just listening. And basically, he was complaining that the U.S. wasn't giving him enough assistance. He said, "We're your best friend. We vote for you in the United Nations all the time. We're the only country that votes with you 100%. And whatever you need, we give you. You want your planes to land, your military to come here and operate. We have bases here. And yet you treat me like an orphan. I don't get anything." So he went on and on and on and on. So Secretary Shultz listened, and he said, "Mr. President, I'll see what I can do. You know, we'll review all of our policies, and thank you for your thing." And so that caused us to review our whole policy toward Liberia at the time.
And I want to follow up with Charles Taylor. After you left the State Department, you became a consultant.
Yes.
And I think then you eventually went to give some consultant advice to Charles Taylor in terms of his economic policy.
Yes.
You mentioned that instead of Taylor taking the road to reform and rebuilding, Taylor decided to become a regional warlord.
I really was very impressed when I went there. He invited me to come to talk to him about the economic future of Liberia. It was shortly after he was elected, and he gave me freedom to visit all the government offices and talk to everyone. And I was very, very impressed by the deputy minister of finance. I wish I could remember his name. He was an extremely competent young man. And he showed me a whole plan that he had for the economic reform of the finances of Liberia. And I looked at it and I said, "This is wonderful." And I took it with me to see Taylor. And I say, "Mr. President, this is what you need. This is what you have to do." He thanked me, and he sent me home, and he said, "I will look at all of this." But he didn't follow anything. He just started using all his money, instead of for reforming the economy, to destabilize Sierra Leone, and then tried to destabilize Guinea. So he took, I don't know what went into his head, but I guess he thought Liberia was too small for him. He had to control much more territory than that. He had ideas of grandeur, I believe.
Ambassador Herman Cohen is the former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. He was speaking with Carol Castile and me on VOA's Press Conference USA, where he was interviewed about his new book, The Mind of the African Strong Man. Many U.S. law enforcement agencies say they are facing a shortage of qualified applicants for their job openings. They say recent news coverage of police brutality and the resulting backlash are causing some potential recruits to think twice about applying for jobs. Elizabeth Lee reports from Los Angeles.
This is the first day of training at the academy. It is called Black Monday. Sergeant Pete Enciso is one of the drill instructors yelling at the trainees.
Our way of greeting them into the academy.
Recruit Christian Davis just finished the 22-week training.
This profession is not for everyone. I actually threw up on Black Monday just from nerves alone.
It's your day one, recruit.
The trainees are standing in rows in the heat. Enciso says there is a lesson here.
The way they learn to work through the stress and the way they learn to function and be able to concentrate through different stressors, it's going to be the same type of thing out in patrols.
The real world stresses these days are heightened because of a feeling of distrust and fear of the police among some citizens and nationwide protests as a response to police-involved shootings. L.A. County Assistant Sheriff Todd Rogers says this environment discourages some people from applying for a job.
This is a tough time for the law enforcement profession's image. And I think some people are shying away from the profession because they don't want to be subjected to the scrutiny, the abuse.
This type of sentiment adds to the already difficult job of getting funding for positions and finding qualified candidates. The Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, the largest in the country, has openings for 800 deputies. Typically, 3 out of 100 applicants will graduate from the academy. Sergeant Robert Pickowitz of Riverside County Sheriff's Department, east of Los Angeles, says there are also some intangible qualities that are important.
We're looking for somebody who's physically fit, obviously, but we want somebody who can speak well, represent the department, be smart enough to have some common sense in very difficult situations.
L.A. County Sheriff Jim McDonald tries to prepare the new graduates in his speech at graduation.
And in no other profession will you be held, and appropriately so, to so much accountability. You've seen that for yourself in the news over the past year. While many professions get easier over time, law enforcement seems to get more challenging by the day.
Officers say winning over the public's trust means having a certain mental toughness to handle the stress and yet have compassion for people. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Owuma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin at the All Africa Games in Brazzaville, Republic of Congo. Sudan pipped Zimbabwe 1-0 as the Republic of Congo edged Burkina Faso 2-1 in men's football, as South Africa and Ghana drew 0-0 in women's game on Thursday. Tomorrow, Saturday, Senegal play Nigeria in men's contest as the Republic of Congo engage Tanzania and Nigeria face Ivory Coast in the women's football. On Sunday, Sudan play Burkina Faso and Republic of Congo meet Zimbabwe in men's football as Cameroon engage Ghana in the women's action. In women's basketball, Cameroon beat Mozambique 60-49. Ivory Coast outwitted Algeria 72-56. Nigeria pipped Mali 70-69. And Angola beat Gabon 60-49 on Thursday. In men's action, Egypt dismissed Seychelles 78-48 as Angola overpowered Gabon 104-49. Today, Friday, in the men's action, Nigeria face Mali. Republic of Congo challenge Egypt. Mozambique face Ivory Coast, while in the women's contest, Gabon engage Seychelles and Senegal play Algeria. Tomorrow, Saturday, in women's basketball, Republic of Congo challenge Mali as Mozambique face Nigeria. In men's action, Angola plays Seychelles, Gabon engage Republic of Congo and Nigeria tackle Mozambique. On Sunday, in the women's game, Gabon play Ivory Coast, Mozambique meet Republic of Congo, and Cameroon engage Nigeria as Angola face Senegal, while in men's action, Mali play Mozambique and Ivory Coast challenge Nigeria. Turning to athletics, Botswana's Nigel Amos faces Burundi's Antoine Gakeme and Kenya's Ashbel Kiprop in the 800 meters at this season's last IWF Diamond League meet in the Belgian capital Brussels today, Friday. Victory for Amos means he wins the Diamond League trophy for 800 meters for the second consecutive year. Meanwhile, a showdown looms large between Ethiopians Hagos Gebrehiwet and Yomif Kejelcha, along with Kenyans Caleb Mwangangi Ndiku and Thomas Longisiwa, to determine the 5,000 meter Diamond League trophy winner. Kenya's Virginia Nyambura seeks her first Diamond League trophy in women's 3,000 meter steeplechase. Standing in her way are challengers Tunisian Habiba Gribi, Kenyan Hyvin Kiyang, and Ethiopian Hiwot Ayeleu. On the infield, Kenyan Julius Yego and Egypt's Ihab Abdel Rahman El Sayed compete in javelin. Elsewhere, hosts Italy beat Egypt 5-1 in beach soccer final at the inaugural Mediterranean Beach Games in Pescara. Libya pipped Morocco 4-3 in the bronze medal playoff. And that's it for Debris Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend, and we'll see you again on Monday morning. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The fossilized bones of 15 members of an ancient species related to humans have been discovered in a cave in South Africa, scientists said on Thursday, hailing the find as a breakthrough in evolution research. That is it for this Friday, September 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, and reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Marco Uman, I am James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you a very good weekend.
Next on Let's Talk, nicknames. Do you like yours? Remember who gave it to you? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing nicknames. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa. Next on Straight Talk Africa, Shaka Ssali goes one-on-one with Uganda's Minister for Foreign Affairs, Sam Kutesa, the outgoing President of the United Nations General Assembly. The 69th session ends Tuesday. Mr. Kutesa will be with us live next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on Straight Talk Africa. That's next time on VOA Africa.